Today I'm going to talk about a sort of different type of labour, one that's often deliberately effaced by the interface. The labour that lies at the back end of digital illustration resources. Now this labour might be hidden, but I hope to show that it has some crucial implications for how we understand the ambiguous and complex graphic art form of illustration, the pictures that accompanied words in Victorian newspapers, magazines, and books. Now, as is always the case with these things, it's way too risky to do a live demo of these archives because you can guarantee they'll crash. So I'm not going to do a live demo. Instead, I'm going to show you the results of an online search that I did earlier. So you will recognise some of these buildings here. I've only got a screenshot of the first row of results. You'll see the keyword I put into the archive there is Caen. And there were actually 232 results returned. Another quick search uncovered 1,000 illustrations relating to Normandy, 10,000 relating to France. We know we have many more than that in the archive that are not yet searchable. So this suggests the scale, not only of this digital archive, which I'm going to talk about today, but of illustration in general in this period. It was everywhere. Now, geographical illustrations only form a very small part of this data set. The website that I'm actually using here is the Illustration Archive. You can see the details up there. We developed this site in Cardiff. It was funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. It's a publicly accessible website, so I do encourage you to go online and to have a look. It includes over 1 million searchable illustrations from books from the 18th to the 20th century on every conceivable topic. So geography, literature, philosophy, history. When I was listening to the last talks, I did a sort of quick search to see, you know, the relevant illustrations that we had on the archive. We had several hundred Cries of London from an edition that was designed and engraved by the Buicks. So it might be worth looking at that. And thousands on China and the Opium Wars. So there are many, many illustrations in this data set. The images are free to use, so this is open access. We have tens of thousands of images related in some way to labour and the body. So it might be worth browsing. Now, in an age of Google, embarking on online searches like the one that I've just done has become second nature to us. The results seem to appear out of nowhere. Typing a search term is like turning on a light switch. We no longer question how it works or consider the work that has gone into making it work. The user's engagement with digital resources like this tends to mask the labour that's taken place behind the glossy veneer of the interface. And the aim of this paper is in a way to scrub away that veneer and to expose some of the digital work that was involved in the creation of two online illustration resources. The Illustration Archive, where users can search and tag book illustrations and make their own collections and exhibitions. And an earlier project that, again, I headed up in Cardiff. And this too is publicly accessible. The Database of Mid-Victorian Illustration, or DMVI for short. DMVI, a much smaller data set here, so this includes around 900 searchable wood-engraved illustrations from the middle of the 19th century. This project ran between 2004-2007, so it's still there online. Again, the images are free to use. It's starting to show its age a little bit. That's the case always, of course, with these digital resources. Technology is moving so fast, but nevertheless, the searchable illustrations are there. And I should say, really, that my objective in going behind the scenes of these resources isn't to sort of complain about the amount of unrecognised work that went into these resources, although it was a lot of work, but to suggest that, you know, while this labour might be invisible, it's never wasted. The work that we did here revealed aspects of illustration that we'd never thought about or seen before. So the academic possibilities of the digital exist as much in the creation of these resources as they do in the finished outputs. So to start with then, our work plan. One of the first tasks that's usually undertaken on projects like these is the scanning and digitization of the illustrated material, which depends, of course, on a prior conceptualization of what the archive, what the digital archive should contain. Now, in the case of the illustration archive, the digitization had already been done for us. We used a data set of books here from the British Library that had been scanned by Microsoft. Now, I don't know if you remember this going back several decades now. This was when Google Books really started, and Microsoft were in competition with Google Books at the time to scan as many books in libraries as possible. So the data set that we use in the Illustration Archive was actually created by Microsoft. And it contains 68,000 volumes from the British Library. So that's the sort of scale that we're dealing with here. Most of the books cluster around the 18th and 19th centuries. So Microsoft had basically scanned their way across the British Library stacks. This actually was quite a small collection in the context of the British Library, but they'd scanned their way along the stacks, rejecting books that were too large or too small to fit onto their scanners at the time. And Microsoft's aim here was, of course, to scan the words. That's what they were interested in. It was the words in the books. So the illustrations were really a byproduct of this digitization project. They just happened to be there. But the illustrations, of course, is precisely what we were interested in. So that was the sort of genesis of the illustration archive. The database of mid-Victorian illustration, DMVI, had very different, I suppose, more humble beginnings. This project, as I said, we undertook it in 2004-07, and it involved setting up our own flatbed scanners in special collections and libraries and digitising the material ourselves. So we had more control in this project over how the illustrations were digitised and how they would eventually appear online. But this brings with it its own set of challenges and problems. The transformation of historical illustrations from their analogue context in books or magazines to a digital space raises questions about the visibility of illustrations, or indeed the lack of visibility. While illustrations are often concealed and hidden away between the cover of books, a digital environment puts them on display. So there needs to be some consideration then of how these images are displayed. What elements of their visual identity should be emphasised or marginalised? Digitisation is often thought of as a very mechanical process. And in some ways, of course, it is, but it also involves decisions about the resolution of the image, the level of detail that can and should be seen, whether or not the picture should be cleaned up or photoshopped. So in this way, digitization and associated processes, like photoshopping, establish what is visually significant and distinct about illustration as a genre. In some online illustration resources, this labor of digitizing and manipulating the images is on display. And I thought I'd give a little plug here for this online resource. This is the Victorian Illustrated Shakespeare Archive, which was created by one of my PhD students in Cardiff as part of his PhD project. And the archive includes illustrations from four major Victorian editions of Shakespeare. And the images here are heavily photoshopped. So they're cropped to maximize the viewing experience. The foxing of the page has been removed. The patina has been whitewashed. But what's been done here is that the cropped, cleaned up image is placed alongside the original digitized page, the raw digitized page, which you can see in that picture below there. And I think this sort of conjunction of the old picture and the new picture can be quite unsettling, evoking perhaps a nostalgia, you know, for the original illustration with its foxing, with the words that bleed through the page. And the juxtaposition of old and new raises questions about the identity of illustration, of what constitutes its visual core or essence. And actually, it raises questions of whether an unmediated original illustration is even possible in the context of mass-produced Victorian illustrated books. So this rust-coloured page, the original page that you see on the screen here, happens to be just one of multiple material copies. Each one is different from the next. And the digitised image is different again. It's not the same. It's, you know, it's a different image, not simply an unmediated version of the original page. So going back to the Database of Mid-Victorian Illustration there, DMVI, one of our main objectives here in making these illustrations visible was to emphasise their identity as wood engravings. All 900 images in this database were wood engraved. In the middle of the 19th century, this was the main technique for reproducing images ready for printing. So the work involved meticulously cutting around the image on a wood block, cutting around the artist's design and leaving the part to be inked standing up or in relief so that it could be printed on the same page as the letterpress. The art of the wood engraver began to decline in the latter decades of the 19th century because then photomechanical techniques became more dominant. Today, I think when we look at illustrations today, when we look at Victorian illustrations in books, in magazines, in newspapers, we tend to look past or through the technique by which that illustration was produced. We look at the subject of the picture. We don't always look, you know, at its materiality, those techniques that actually produced it. And in DMVI, we wanted to sort of offer the possibility of halting that looking through the image to the subject, and to bring the craft of the art engraver, the labour of the wood engraver, to the fore. So we did this in several ways. One of the things we did was to identify the wood engravers in all of the images in this resource. Now, this isn't always an easy task. Sometimes you find monograms of the engraver's signature, but they're not always there. It's usually the big wood engraving companies that include signatures. And this, of course, is evidence of the way that actually wood engraving was seen as a sort of very humble profession. You know, wood engravers weren't real artists. They were the copyists, the people who just cut around the design on the woodblock. So they didn't really have the status that the artist had. So we went about trying to identify the wood engravers who were involved in the production of these images. Which means that the end result, of course, for the user is that if you're using this database, you can actually search the entire corpus of material by the name of the wood engraver. So that was one way in which we wanted to emphasize wood engraving. We also wanted to reveal the craft of wood engraving in a very sort of visual, spectacular way. So to do this, we used a magnification tool called Zoomify. Now, in 2004, when we started this project, this was cutting-edge technology. But of course, you see these sort of magnification tools all the time now. And what this allows the user to do, Zoomify, is to zoom in on various parts of the image. So here, we've got a rather beautiful wood engraving there. And you can zoom in on the image and really see the details of those lines. I mean, it's quite extraordinary looking at a picture like this to realise that all those lines were cut by hand, that each black line you see there was cut away on either side by the wood engraver. So, yes, quite a craft. And the magnification of these wood engraved illustrations reveals the complexity of those lines, those details that can't really be viewed with the naked eye. Zoomify, as a tool, is part of what J. David Bolter and Richard Grusin have called remediation. You might have come across this term, remediation, the assimilation of old forms in new media. But Zoomify, I think, also works in reverse. Harking back to reveal a visuality that existed prior to the printed illustration. The image as seen and worked upon by the engravers, who often used magnifying lenses as they worked. And I've got a photograph there of wood engravers at work. Quite a sort of rare photograph from a bit later in the century, but you can see them working on the blocks there. You can see how close their eyes are to the actual blocks. And one of the occupational hazards of wood engraving was blindness. Unfortunately, many wood engravers did go blind, but they worked with magnifying lenses. You can see a young apprentice at work there too. The digital labour that's involved in making illustrations available online is part of an active engagement in questions of what constitutes the distinct visual identity of an illustration. And as well as making these images visible, we also wanted to make them searchable. So in DMVI and the Illustration Archive, the user can search for the relevant image in terms of the bibliographic information attached to the illustration. So the name of the engraver, the name of the illustrator, the author, the publication title, the year. So this is the search page, the advanced search page that the user is greeted with on the Illustration Archive. And you can see the categories by which you can search the material here. The Illustration Archive uses a sort of automatic function, an automatic complete function, so that as you type, the titles come up. You know, it automatically limits the titles. It modifies the information. In DMVI, this is the search page. So again, you get a sense of the categories by which you can search. These are drop-down boxes. So if you click, for example, on that author box there at the top, you get a full list of the authors that are represented in the data set. Now, of course, we could do this with DMVI because we had a smaller corpus of material. you know, 900 images compared to the million in the illustration archive. But in a way, even though DMVI was a much smaller database, it was more challenging to make these illustrations searchable than the million in the illustration archive, because with the illustration archive, we drew on the British Library catalogue entries. So we had the bibliographic metadata there. It was in the BL, the British Library catalogue entries. But in DMVI, we were using a collection of illustration that had been cut out of magazines and periodicals by a Victorian enthusiast, a Victorian collector, and pasted onto card. So they had actually been removed from their printed context. And some of these images came with information, might just say the Cornhill magazine, 1862. Sometimes there was no information at all. So when we were looking through these images, when we were digitising them, there was also quite a bit of detective work involved, tracing those images back to their original context. A bibliographic search, of course, you know, a search by author, title, illustrator, engraver, is really useful if users of the archive have an idea of what they're looking for. So if you want to look for illustrations by, you know, accompanying the work of a specific author, then you would look via this bibliographic metadata. But we also wanted to make these illustrations searchable by picture content. Now, this actually was the real challenge. In other words, we wanted to make them searchable by what they showed, what they depicted, you know, their features, their iconographic features. And this type of searchability has actually turned out to be really quite effective, because the images in DMVI have actually been used and reused by multiple sort of industries and in a variety of contexts. So we've had illustrations from this archive used in films, in graphic design, in television programmes, even in the Ant and Dec show. If you're in the UK, the Ant and Dec show is a really big thing on a Saturday night. And some of the illustrations from the database were used on that show, because the TV producers, you know, the filmmakers, could search these pictures by content. One filmmaker, for example, wanted pictures of donkeys. So they turned to this database because you can search it and you can find pictures of donkeys. For the Ant and Dec show, they wanted, I think, pictures of strawberries. So very sort of random searches going on, but opens up the content of these illustrations to different users. Now, in order for these illustrations to be searchable by content, they need to be marked up. They need to be marked up in terms of their content. So somebody, some developer in all of these resources is actually labelling everything that's in the image, is describing what's in the image. Now, in 2004, when we embarked on this particular project, we did look at the possibility of automating this process, of getting the computer to identify what's in these illustrations, what's in the pictures. But computer vision, you might have heard of computer vision, but then it was very much in its infancy. It wasn't developed enough, it wasn't sophisticated enough to be able to discern what was in these pictures. When we started on the illustration archive, that was about a decade later, quite recently, 2014, we looked again at computer vision as a possibility for marking up these images. But great advances had been made in this field, including, of course, facial recognition, which we've all heard about and is a type of computer vision tool. But actually, it was still too difficult for this to be done automatically. Computer vision doesn't really work on a huge visual data set of images that are ridiculously diverse. Computer vision usually relies on similar types and formats of images, photographs, for example. Or, you know, facial recognition actually is in a way quite limited because it depends on the certain profile of the individual. So looking across this data set, there was no way that computer vision would be able to explain what was in these pictures. So with computers unable to take on the labor of making the content of illustrations searchable, this task falls to database developers and to users, which I'll talk about in a minute, and also to words. The most common method for making picture content searchable online is tagging or keywording. A process where the images are described in words and the end users can retrieve those relevant images using the words, so search terms. And tagging has been employed in a variety of contexts online, from websites, connected resources. Actually, search engines like Google rely very, very heavily on image tags. Even when you do a Google image search, what's going on the back end there involves words. It's textual. So as a mechanism for describing the visual content of pictures in words, tagging, of course, has implications for the relation between word and image that defines illustration. The marking up of an illustration could itself be described as an illustrative act. You know, you're adding words, another layer of words, to pictures. The tagging of an illustration writes the image, adding a textual dimension to the illustration. So there seems to be a sort of textual excess going on here. But actually, this excess is predicated on a lack or deficiency. And what I mean by that is that while there are numerous schema and guidelines for the marking up of texts so they can be searched, when those texts are converted to human readable forms, I don't know if you know the Text Encoding Initiative, TEI. This is the most sort of well-known methodology for marking up texts, but there are other ways of marking up texts that allows newspapers, poetry, novels to be searched online. But there are no equivalent guidelines for marking up illustrations, or even actually for marking up images. This is very sort of text-centric. So there were no guidelines there that provided the standards for how we go about describing what illustrations show, how they show it, what their positioning is on the page. None of this stuff exists. So what's happened as a result is that illustrations have tended to go unmarked up. So if you search, you know, many of you will be familiar, for example, with ProQuest online archives, you know, online archives of newspapers, 19th century periodicals online. You might not have even noticed this, but actually you can't search the content of the illustrations at all. All you can search is the text. So sometimes, of course, you're fortunate because the text will happen to bring up a picture, a relevant picture with it. But actually, in their own right, these great online resources don't contain searchable illustrations. This is another danger, really, when we're dealing with online illustrated works, historical illustrated works, is that actually, in a way, there seems to be this huge accessibility. You know, we can suddenly access all this data, but there's the real danger that illustrations will get lost. In this, you know, in this tech-centric online universe, they will disappear, they'll get lost, you won't be able to retrieve them. So the only option we had really when we were sort of working on these projects is to develop our own bespoke keywording systems for marking up the content of these illustrations. And in the case of DMVI, this, as I said, was a relatively small corpus of images, 900 illustrations. So we could tag these pictures ourselves. It was labour intensive. We had 900 pictures to look at and describe. And we had to establish a vocabulary that we could use across the entire data set. So it was labour intensive. And of course, it raises all sorts of questions about what you actually see when you look at an image. How do you even go about tagging or keywording a Victorian illustration? So this is one here. And to test our sort of keywording protocol, we decided, when we were working on DMVI, to show an illustration to some volunteers and to ask them to describe in words what they saw. So this is the illustration that we sent to our test taggers. And there was an enormous variation in what people said about this picture. For a start, there were different ways of organising the descriptions. So some of our testers used a random set of keywords. Others divided the list of keywords up into actions, you know, objects, background, foreground. And what became most evident to us is that while trying to list everything there is in this picture, people inevitably focused on particular areas. So for example, we had a museum curator. One of our test taggers was a museum curator who specialized in Victorian fashion. So she detailed every part of, you know, Victorian dress that you see in this illustration, but she missed out carriages. Which is what these dressed people are actually riding in. So it does present problems. Another tagger saw the binoculars that the lady in the foreground there is holding. Can you see she's holding binoculars there? That's a close-up, so you can see they are binoculars. But for some reason, one of our test taggers thought that these weren't binoculars, it was a letter, and built up an entire tagging description based upon this letter that she's trying to pass to a lover. Or so there was another sort of story that was being created in the tagging process. So the responses that we received to this tagging experiment emphasized, you know, that whenever we look at an image, however objective we try to be, we're always interpreting it. So the way we annotate images in the digital archive is always related to our own cultural values, whether we're conscious of these values or not. And we don't always see everything there is to be seen. So some viewers are blind to features that to other viewers seem glaringly obvious. Tagging raises the question of what's invisible and what's visible in an illustration. Paradoxically, one aspect of illustration that tagging tends to overlook is the visuality of the image. Those aspects that are simply taken for granted, that you just see but you don't think to tag. The colour illustrations in the illustration archive, for example, I mean, in DMVI, these are all black and white, but in the illustration archive, these are colour illustrations. And something we've noticed is that our taggers very rarely, if ever, tag the illustrations as colour. They just see the colour as just being there. They take it for granted. Then there's the associated issue of what should or should not be marked up or tagged in an image. Are the tags man, woman, or people sufficient? Or should features and clothing also be described? One of our taggers tagged nose, mouth, ears for every person. Now, this might seem excessive, but of course it's not wrong. So these are, you know, issues that you deal with. And a specific issue actually arises in relation to the body, which is the subject of this symposium. Do we tag body in all our illustrations of people, or do we only label a body if this is the subject of the image, or if the body is emphasized in some way? And how do we decide if this is the case? Because that immediately becomes a type of interpretation. What of the relationship between the objects? This relationship can't be articulated in single keywords. So if you take tags like woman, parasol, binoculars, carriages, that doesn't express how these features actually interact in the image. And you might think that the answer to this is to just forget keywords and go instead for a prose description. Make the image searchable by a prose description instead of keywording. But actually, prose descriptions of the image are every bit as problematic as keywords. In some senses, they're more problematic because something we found is that the more spontaneous nature of describing an image in sentences means that actually more things tend to get left out. So we're always thinking, of course, of the end user. If that term is left out, then the end user cannot find the image using that term. So there are risks involved with all these different types of labelling the image. So the illusion of the equivalence of word and image on which keywords depend is actually only ever an illusion. Words do not seamlessly map onto pictures because they're different modes of representation. So the activity of tagging is not one of mapping at all, but it is actually one of interpretation. And this really presented problems for us when we were developing DMVI, because actually we didn't want the focus to be on our interpretation of the images. What we wanted was to make these images available and searchable for others to interpret. So we tried to cling on to this idea of objectivity, which all the time was sort of dismantling before us. So it's extremely difficult to negotiate between a rigorous system of empirical observation that stands up to the demands of computer processing and a recognition of the ideologically informed structures of the system. Another problem that emerged during the development of the keywording system for DMVI was the extent to which we could or should use the text to help us to mark up the image. Now, in some cases, this was impossible for practical reasons, because we were using a data set where the images had already been taken out of their textual context. They'd basically been cut out of the magazines and stuck onto card. Sometimes we didn't have the text there. But there's also a critical issue at stake in using the text to mark up the image. To use Roland Barthes' term, words can anchor the illustration. They can steer an interpretation of the image or suggest new and different meanings that the image does not have independently. And this is really something that was exposed to us when we were working on the archive, because we were largely looking at these images here independently. So for example, if you have recourse to the text might specify a family relationship between figures that isn't obvious from the picture alone. So, you know, figures that might be marked up as boy and girl become brother and sister if you read the text. Likewise, you know, an indistinct snowy landscape suddenly becomes Canada when you read the textual accompaniment. But this sort of textual anchoring isn't a one-way process. Illustration also anchors the meanings of texts. And determines how they're read. So a simple drawing room in the text, countless examples, of course, of drawing rooms in mid-Victorian fiction, but these are furnished in the illustrations. And these pictorial details generate their own meanings about domesticity, class, gender. An illustration can also define what someone looks like. So if we think about the iconic figure of Sherlock Holmes, for example, with his deerstalker cap and his pipe, actually that image, that iconic figure of Sherlock Holmes, comes not from the text, but from the original illustrations that appeared in the Strand magazine. So there's this very complex relationship between text and image that became really quite apparent to us when we were trying to sort of dismantle it to create these methodologies for describing illustrations. So tagging or keywording an illustration depends on the fixity and stability of the relationship between word and image. The notion that a word can stand in for a feature of an image. But the creation of this digital space exposes the very gaps between word and image. And I thought I'd just show you the keywording system that we eventually came up with. You can't sort of see it all there. You need to go onto the actual site. We did come up with a keywording system. It's not perfect. It's a sort of hierarchical tree-like structure that drills down into other terms. And it makes the keywording quite effective and quite detailed. And this system that we developed here for keywording the illustrations on DMVI has since been adopted by other illustration archives around the world. So we're quite happy about that. But this very clean structure that you've got online there hides the dirty work that went into producing it and the critical issues that are generated in the labour of trying to describe a picture in words. So in a closed corpus of material like DMVI, the creation of a bespoke keywording structure is an effective, if problematic, mechanism for making the content of pictures searchable. But in the illustration archive, we had to do things differently. The number and variety of illustrations in this data set, over a million, covering several centuries, using various reproductive techniques, meant that it was impossible to tag these images ourselves. We couldn't even see all the images in the data set. There are a million of them. We still haven't seen them all. So when I did my search on Cries of London today, those were images I'd never seen before. So we couldn't tag these pictures ourselves. So we decided to try something different and to crowdsource this task. So in other words, we have invited users of the archive to help us tag the illustrations, to make them searchable. So please feel free to help us when you look at the archive, you know, tag a few images while you're there, because what you're doing, of course, is making this picture content searchable for others. And crowdsourcing has really come into its own in image archives, where members of the public are cajoled, enticed, petitioned into looking at images and describing what they see. And of course, this whole process of crowdsourcing images draws on the practice of marking up photographs on social media. So it's that sort of activity. And in large, in big visual data sets, crowdsourcing is still really seen as one of the only methods that can make picture content searchable until we come up with computer vision processes that can do it for us automatically. Of course, there are many ethical issues involved with crowdsourced labour. And the creators of digital archives have sort of tried to address and negotiate these issues. So if you look at a site like Zooniverse, I don't know if you're familiar with Zooniverse, but this original crowdsourcing project asked users to sort of to keyword galaxies. It was a sort of astrophysics project, really. And the idea was that the contributors would get listed on any papers or articles that came out of the research I don't think to date this has been done. I'm on camera, so I don't want to commit myself. I don't think it's been done because actually it turned out more popular than they expected, and the contributors go into the tens of thousands, even the millions. So you couldn't possibly list all these people, you couldn't attribute them on a research paper. So it does lead to problems. There's another critical issue at stake here with crowdsourcing, which involves the reliability and the value of the tags of the crowdsourced data. Now, most people would think that this reliability, that the problem here is actually, you know, the tags are not as reliable because they come from amateurs rather than professionals. But actually, this is not what I've found at all. In my experience, the critical issue regarding the sort of value of the tags actually lies with the digital developer rather than with the tagger. In other words, digital developers need to get the questions right. They need to be asking the right questions that allows the crowdsourced task to be performed by the user. So I think in the Illustration Archive, we formulated very targeted questions about the illustrations to make it easier, really, and more enjoyable, I hope, for the tagger. So I'll just show you some of these tagging tasks. How am I doing on time, Françoise? Am I okay? Fine. Will you tell me when I need to be quiet? So this is, if you go onto the archive, this is the first question that we ask our taggers. I was so delighted to actually see this building in the flesh, as it were. Still there. I mean, it's extraordinary. So this is the first question we ask our tagger. You'll see the tagging question there is on the other side of the screen. And users are asked to identify the type of illustration that they're looking at. And users can choose multiple types. So here it would be, for example, a photograph and a location. Now, each of these buttons drills down to further options. So we're moving the tagger in the direction of these very sort of consistent, controlled tags. So they drill down to other options. Now, our objective in starting with this question, in asking the tagger to identify the type of illustration, wasn't because we wanted to formulate a classificatory list of illustrations, but rather we wanted to make some sense of the diversity of the images in the data set. And to enable the end user, because always we're thinking of this end user, to enable the end user to search the archive using this term. So it might well be that people come into this archive are interested in churches, so they would search for churches. But then again, there might be people who would be interested in looking at all the photographs we have. So we need that type of sort of searchability as well. Again, though, we came up against the problem that illustration as a genre hasn't been given the scholarly attention that it deserves. So what we really needed here, what we spent ages searching for, is a list of types of illustration. You would think that this has to exist somewhere, you know, this typology. But there is no established typology of illustration. Illustration is really quite problematic because even the very notion of a type slips around all over the place. What is a type? Well, a type of illustration might include the mode of illustration, so it might be a plate, vignette, title page, frontispiece, pictorial capital letter. The type might include the reproductive technique by which it was printed, so photography, lithography, etching, engraving. It could refer to a generic category of illustration, advertisement, portrait, literary, or it could refer to the subject matter, images depicting buildings, flora, fauna. So there are many different types of type. And the type of illustration isn't even tied to the type of book in which the illustration appears. So you'll know that books are, they're classified according to established conventions. These conventions have changed over time, but there is a sort of broad classification of books. But illustrations don't conform to the same classifications. And this was strikingly apparent in the British Library data set that we were using here, where the books were classified as literature, philosophy, history, and geography. Those were the types of books that we were dealing with. But when you think about a book of philosophy, we have a sort of idea of what a book of philosophy is, or the sort of things that it should contain. But it's very difficult to imagine what a philosophical illustration would look like. So the illustrations don't always really fit into the books. An illustration of, say, the Battle of Bosworth Field could well be literary, geographical, historical. So they move across sort of textual genres. They jump between textual genres. In our data set, there's an illustration of Falstaff, Shakespeare's Falstaff, which appears in a travel book about the River Thames. So the illustrations jump around between textual genres, and there are often multiple types of illustration within a single book. And there's not even a standard vocabulary for describing those types of illustration that do seem specific to illustration. So, for example, you'll see here this rather beautiful pictorial capital letter. It's a C. And these are very common in the data set. We have hundreds of thousands of them. I've called it a pictorial capital letter, but these letters are also known as decorated initials, historiated letters, illuminated letters. So actually there's no sort of established vocabulary for describing illustrations. And the same is true of ornaments. So these illustrative flourishes that you see in books and books and periodicals of the period, we have over 400,000 of these in the data set, and they are called decorations, embellishments, motifs, ornaments, and these plural terms aren't necessarily synonymous. They can actually have different meanings and values. You know, when you use the term ornament, that comes with certain sort of baggage. So as part of a text and separate from it, spoken for and unclassified, illustration is stateless and nameless. As we developed the mechanisms for making the illustration searchable in the illustration archive, we had to negotiate this lack of an established vocabulary for describing illustration, even as we attempted to produce a workable definition that enabled us to ask the question, what type of illustration is this? It seems an obvious question, but actually it's not. Our list of types also needed to be constructed with the demands and protocols of crowdsourced image tagging in mind. So this was another set of considerations. A key consideration for us was the potential diversity of our tagging community. They might not all be scholars who are working on illustrated material. So taking this into consideration, we decided to visually define our list of types. So each type is sort of displayed there as a miniature illustration itself. So you can see an example of the sort of illustration that we're trying to get our users to tag. Now you might notice that this list doesn't include reproductive types like wood engraving or lithography, because they're very difficult to identify for a non-specialist, even sometimes actually for a specialist, particularly in digitized versions of the images, where the quality isn't always consistent. We included photography on the basis that this is easier to identify. So taggers are more likely to identify a photograph than they are a lithograph. But the tagging system that we've employed here does allow other information, extra information, to be inputted by the tagger. So there's a free text box in the end where you can put in information that we haven't asked for, but that you might know. So as I mentioned, the tagging types here drill down to other types. We had to make sure that our types fitted onto one screen. Ironically, it's been chopped off here in my lovely PowerPoint presentation, I'm sorry. But one of those tags, that one of those boxes there at the bottom says none of these. So you always need a none of these box, because you can guarantee that there will be images that don't fit into these types at all. So, as a key part of the selection, am I doing okay?
Yes.
Okay. As a key part of the selection of what we included as types of illustration also involved making a judgment about what aspects of illustrations taggers were likely to include in subsequent questions. So, our second question is, are there any other things or ideas in this illustration? So that second question, there it is. That second question there would mop up a lot of information. The tagger could input a lot of stuff there. So we didn't need to include things in our list of types that we thought might be tagged in that second question. So for example, we might have included as a list of types of illustration, animal illustration. We have lots of illustrations of animals, but the idea was that the tagger, if there's a dog in that image, a tagger is likely to put that in question number two. So we don't need it. We only need the one tag. So we didn't need repeat information. So again, this is another thing to consider. It's all to do with anticipating how the user will actually read the image, how they will interpret the image. So the second question, this question that we ask our taggers, seems on the surface at least to be more straightforward. Are there any other things or ideas in this illustration? But however conscientious our taggers are, there does need to be some sort of editorial control. And this is to ensure the consistency of the whole data set. So in the illustration archive, we use an autocomplete function that's connected to a tool called WordNet. Now, WordNet is a lexical database of the English language that groups together words into synonyms, hyponyms, so we get more tags for each tag that's inputted. So if somebody puts in the tag dog, WordNet actually connects this at the back end of the database to synonyms and hyponyms. So you'd also get the tag animal incorporated there too. So I can't really show you this now, but as you type a list of possible scenarios comes up. Actually, yes, so there it is. So I've typed in church and various options come up from the WordNet database, various meanings of church. So the user chooses from those possible options. So WordNet actually does more than complete the tag, it directs the tagger, indicating the most appropriate meaning of that tag. Now, what these multiple meanings display, what these multiple meanings displayed by WordNet suggest, of course, is that language is always political. Bound up in the values of its cultural moment. And that really becomes obvious when you're confronted with a list of definitions here in a particular order. So WordNet's place in the generation of cultural meanings is hinted at in this order in which the system presents the list of possible meanings. So here you'll see the word church, the first meaning that comes up, is for a group of Christians, not for the building, the church, but for that sort of that group of Christians. Now, according to the WordNet site, the order of the result lists, the order of the results here, places the most common usages for those words first in the list. Where there is no sort of common usage, WordNet is entirely random. It's arbitrary. So that order there might be influenced by cultural usage, or it might not, might be completely random. But this does lead to some interesting results. When we were working on the illustration archive, we had to override the sense order of the word woman. Because when we typed woman into the text box there, the tagging box, the first result that WordNet came up with was a human female employed to do housework. So, which relates quite nicely to the labour aspect, in fact, of this symposium. But that was the first thing that came up for woman, a human female employed to do housework. So sometimes you get a sort of random list, but it can have these political connotations that are really quite problematic. Okay, so this is our third of four tagging questions, caption. Again, something that seems relatively straightforward. If the illustration has a caption, a title below the image, please transcribe it. But again, there was the issue here of anticipating what users might come to the archive, who the taggers actually are. We were aiming for cross sections of the community, from school children to picture researchers. And as one of our reviewers pointed out, not everyone knows what a caption is. Now, this is something, of course, you know, you're working on illustration, you just assume that the definition of caption is quite obvious. But actually, if you've got children working on this as part of, you know, a school project, they don't always know what a caption is. So we had to include this very crude definition, actually, and it's slightly inaccurate definition, because you'll see that, I mean, it says there a title below the image, and in most of these illustrations the caption does actually appear below the image, but of course we all know that sometimes captions can appear in different places on the page. But we went for the most sort of the most obvious definition there. And the final question is this additional tag box that that I was talking about. So if you know this particular church, if you know the history of this church, you can input data there that will then help other people who might be searching for this image or searching for other churches. So to conclude, the idea of digital labour is often associated with the end user who interacts with the interface, inputs search terms, scrolls through online pages to find relevant material, and in the case of the illustration archive, who tags the image. But what I hope I've suggested here is that digital labour is actually there from the start, and even before the start, in the conceptualisation and the creation of the digital archive. But I don't want to give the impression that this is all hard work, because the development of these digital resources brings with it considerable pleasures. The pleasure of viewing new material in new ways. I know that, you know, wherever I go to speak in a conference, I can find images of the place. I mean, and these are images, you know, that I've never seen before. And I imagine lots of the material in our data set have not been seen. They have not been seen since the moment of the original publication. So that really is, I mean, it's a discovery, it's a journey of discovery. We have found material here, illustrated material, that we would never have seen in any other context. And there's also the pleasure of thinking through conceptual and critical issues about illustration that would not have arisen outside this digital frame. So this makes all the work seem worth it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.